gonna actually start right there, identify process. Because I think it's a pretty obvious thing to consider all by itself. So you see, for most of the time I'll be talking about signal to background. I'll be talking about a jet mass technique, which seems to be useful for my application, and it hasn't been used much elsewhere. Initial state radiation will emerge as a problem to think about. I'll even try to tackle multi-jets. And you'll also see why I like my favorite event generator. When I get to model building, it'll be more just a bottom-up approach, where I'm looking at some effective operators and symmetries of operators, trying to get a handle on the physics that way. And that'll involve some labor physics. So the process is easy to come up with. You consider a sequential fourth family with at least some CKM mixing with the third. So sequential just means it's a normal family, only change are the masses. So let's consider the fourth family quarks with a mass around 600 GeV. Then either one or the other of these two processes will be important, depending on which one is lighter, T prime or B prime. So for example, if B prime was a lot heavier, it would rather just decay to the T prime instead of doing this. If they're close to enough to each other within the W mass difference, then both of these processes could be important. Now the main point here, though, is colored fermions are involved. So the cross sections are decent at the LHC. Something like this, you see the difference that next to leading order effects can play. So I think it's nicely well-defined here, and I could go right into signal to background. But there's a question, why did I choose 600 GeV? So to answer that, I have to take a detour through some motivation. So we know that nature likes to replicate families, but we don't know why, and that's the flavor problem. But the fourth family is actually a family that could play a role that we could understand, because we know the mass of a fourth family at which something special happens. So above a mass around 550 GeV, the quarks of the fourth family will couple strongly to the Goldstone bosons of electroweak symmetry breaking. So we know then that the fourth family is somehow involved with that dynamics of electroweak symmetry breaking. Meanwhile, a fourth family may actually complete the flavor structure of the theory. There may not be room for any additional families beyond the fourth. So it brings together these two issues, and so I think that's a nice simple-minded motivation that's very old, because it goes way back to when these authors carefully derived that mass for a strongly interacting fermion. So yeah, we all know that strong interactions can unitarize WW scattering. That's also an ancient idea, but going way back to QCD. That's how it handles hard pi scattering. Yeah, the WW scattering is referring to the scattering of those Goldstone bosons. So in our case, though, we don't know what the strong interactions are. So we can still ask, what are the effective propagating degrees of freedom which most influence the scattering? In QCD, that would be the rho. In most theories of electroweak symmetry breaking, it's some kind of scalar or a vector. So this is what's a little different about what I'm talking about. I'm saying those propagating degrees of freedom are fermions. So whatever these strong interactions are, they don't confine these fermions. And that's similar to the old Nambu-Jono-Lasinia model. That's another ancient idea. So I guess you're starting to see a theme here, is ancient ideas. Now there are theories with lots of new fermions, and some of the new modern theories have new vector-like fermions. But vector life means that they're not directly connected with electroweak symmetry breaking, so their masses are not so constrained as what I'm talking about. And their decay modes are much less constrained. They can decay through gluons or Zs rather than the charge current, the W decay that I'm talking about. That's because those fermions can mix in various ways with normal fermions. So the flavor-changing neutral currents that exist in those theories are more suppressed in a sequential family picture. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about doing away with the light Higgs, and yet we keep hearing about how the electroweak data supports the light Higgs. So how can we live without it? Well, what is the main thing that a light Higgs does in fitting to the data? The main thing that it does is to produce a positive contribution to the T parameter. So if you were to remove the light Higgs, you need some other contribution, a positive contribution to delta T. Well, a heavy fermion doublet with some mass splitting does exactly that. It gives you a positive contribution. So, a heavy fourth family can easily give you a positive contribution. So in this sense, living without a light Higgs is not difficult. But still, you're asking, well, just how likely is this picture, since, as you can see, it's not being discussed very much at all. And it's true that it does involve some broken gauge dynamics that we don't have much handle on. And it would also rule out almost everything that's popular today. So the answer to this question, I think, would depend on who you ask. A theorist might say something like this. And this makes sense. How are you supposed to think about something if you can't get much handle on it? But what about an experimentalist? Why would an experimentalist care whether a theorist can get a handle on it or not? So he may have some response like that. It would certainly show that experiment leads theory, if these kinds of ideas were right. So it's this last question that I wanted to try to answer for myself. So that's mostly what I'm going to be talking about. So let's talk about this technique to identify these W's coming off the decays of these heavy quarks. So it's a single jet invariant mass technique, looking at the hadronic decays of the W's. Now these W's are quite highly boosted, so these two jets are close together, so the conventional technique would be to use a small cone size to try to identify these two protojets and construct the two four vectors, and from that the invariant mass. Instead, you could just take a larger cone size and for each energy deposit, use its corresponding four vector, and from all those, construct the invariant mass. So this is a technique I said was not used very much. It has been used by these authors in the study of WW scattering, again, a strongly interacting scenario. It has been considered by the ATLAS collaboration, and that's in the context of mass reconstruction. And it was considered by these authors at exactly the same time I was considering it, and they also were looking at heavy fermions, new heavy fermions, but of the vector-like variety. Apparently he's coming here next week. But for me, I think that the most interesting thing about this technique is that it may actually help to suppress one of the main backgrounds, which is TD bar. For that to be a background, the T's will be quite highly boosted, and so the B and W jets from the top will be close together. So the B jet will contaminate the W jet when you're trying to use this technique. Whereas in the signal, if we're talking about T prime decay, those two jets are farther apart, and this technique should work better. So this helps to suppress the background. So let's just show an example of that. So I'm just plotting the numbers of jets with a given jet mass. And the signal has this nice peak around the W mass. The background here is the TT bar background, and it doesn't show nearly such a peak. You'll see more of these plots later. So this leads to a definition of a W jet as one that has an invariant mass somewhere close within, say, 10 GeV of a peak. And this peak itself doesn't have to be exactly at MW. There are some effects that could cause it to shift. So if that cone didn't capture all the energy, that splash out. And if it captures some unrelated energy, that splash in. And these two effects could cause a shift, but you can experimentally determine where the peak is. So for the detector simulation, I'm using John Conway's PGS-4. I'm sorry he's not here. I'm using it with the Atlas set of parameters. So these are the important settings. The cone, I'm using the cone-based jet finder, although later I will compare it to the KT-based one. I actually did change one parameter, the cone size. That's the thing I've mentioned already, that it had to be quite large, but since the W is quite boosted, it doesn't have to be that large, and 0.6 seems to work pretty well. I have a new student who's just getting started with using ATL FAST in the Athena framework in the Atlas software. And just to check how things depend on the use of PGS-4, and he's finding fairly similar results so far. So for the most part, I'm interested in this process. Of those two that I had, let's look at T prime. And the initial event selection then, well, take the five hardest objects, put a constraint on the scalar PT sum of those, require one B jet with a cut on its PT, and one W jet in the way I've just defined it. So for those two cuts, I find that 2MT prime and MT prime over 3 work pretty well. Of course, in the real data, we won't know what MT prime is. But I'm saying that you can keep the ratio of those two cuts fixed. So it's really just a one parameter scan you'd have to do to optimize the signal. It's important to identify at least one of these Bs, so the detagging efficiencies are important. In PGS, it's tuned for CDF data. And that's not completely appropriate here because these bees are so energetic. And the higher PT those jets are, the worse the efficiencies get. So I've just chosen three values here. These two are the mistag efficiencies. So I think I've chosen the fairly conservative value here.
Why do you say the efficiencies get worse at high PT?
That's what I find in the TDRs. That's
the effects of non-covalent and can't find exposed objects.
What PT? I thought that was super high PT, though.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's
over 600 GeV object. I guess most of these PTs would be. 100 or something like that. I thought that was sort of where the tagging efficiency was best.
Yeah, this means 200 on a cut on their PTs. So, and I think the PGS fit cuts off around 160, and then it just becomes a constant.
Yeah,
whereas,
right.
Whereas it should be going down a bit.
Okay, well,
the HD distribution is often looked at, and it's interesting here. It's, you know, it's the scalar PT sum of everything in the event. And it's interesting because the signal has a, is peaking at, on the tail of this distribution. It's peaking at high HT, whereas the background it is just is much larger at lower HT and just has a tail up there. So why not just look for this peak and just call it quits? Well, the background is the problem. So here are two estimates of the TT bar background, and we'll be looking at where these estimates come from in a second. But the signal's way down here. So, and so there's a peak, but it's so small, it's hopeless. So the T prime mass reconstruction is essential. So we've identified W's and B's in all our events now, so we just take pairs of those things, construct their invariant masses, and try to come up with a T prime mass reconstruction plot. So you'll be seeing those along with the W mass plot, like the one you've already seen. So a few words about event generators. Of course, this is mostly an issue for the background, trying to estimate it properly. Let me call the first one Mackinlow because that's easy to say. So it's the only one that has the one loop amplitudes and also the amplitudes for one extra hard parton. So it properly describes one extra hard jet. For more jets, which is also something you would like to do properly, then you can consider AlpGen, which at least has the correct tree level amplitudes for extra hard partons. And that's something that's not even in standalone Herwig or standalone Pythia. But standalone Pythia is of interest because it does have various descriptions of other kinds of physics that can affect the background, like initial state radiation and the underlying event. So it'll be interesting to see how these various things compare to each other. In each case, though, we'll at least try to calculate both the signal and the background using the same tool, so it's a fair comparison. So for the backgrounds, I'll consider TT bar first. It's, of course, a serious one because it has the same final state as the signal. And you've already seen how big it is. But then I'll also try to consider QCD multijet. And we'll see that we'll have to introduce further cuts to try to handle that background. But once we do that, then everything else you can consider, and I have considered these, or looked at them anyway, are basically eliminated. So if we didn't have the QCD multijet background, we could have just kept with those cuts, the event selection that I've already shown you. Could have handled all these as well. Maybe this one is of comparable size to TT bar. So let's look at Mackinlow first. So it has the one loop corrections built in, so it's good for getting the absolute rates, which may not be a big deal if we're just interested in signal to background. But it's for standard model stuff, so how do we describe a fourth family? Well, I'll cheat. I'll take the top mass, raise it to 600 GeV, and let its decay model the decay that I'm interested in. So I'll model the signal that way. In the way Mackinlow operates, it produces some negative weights, so sometimes you'll see some negative results on histograms. And I'll also scale everything to 2.5 inverse femtobars.
So what are the loops that are included in Mackinlow? Is it only the final state radiation?
No, every possible.
So, does, for instance, does it include a Higgs loop in the TT bar process?
No, no, this is just strong loops. Glue on loops.
Okay.
So here's the result. So here's the W mass plot like you've seen before, and here's our T prime mass reconstruction plot. And that's not a bad signal to background.
Does that place a cut in the MW distribution before constructing the second plot?
Yeah, I defined a W jet to be something within 9 GeV, actually, of 80. So that the fact that this is doing so well is an indication that that method is helping. Now, Mackinac allows you just to turn off the Mackinac part of that package and just look at standalone Hurwitz. Then you get a surprising result. For standalone Hurwitz, the background, at least in this plot, goes way up. It doesn't carry over quite as much to this plot, though, although it is higher background. So we could ask, what in the world is standalone Hurwitz doing? Well, let's look at our HT distribution again. So here's our plot that we've seen before. And now we know what these curves are. The top one is standalone Hurwitz, giving you a much larger background than Mackinac. So this is on the HT tail. If you look at the full HT distribution, it's the opposite effect. The next to leading order effects enhance, give you a larger cross-section. And that's the well-known K-factor. So it's of interest. It seems to reverse at high HT. And it's so we could naively say that this is the result of next to leading order, but there's still the question of what in the world is standalone Hurwitz doing out here? Is it doing something crazy? So let's look at some of the other tools, Alpgen Hurwitz.
So can I just remind myself, standalone mm-hmm. Hurwitz has the angle of order in it.
Yes. Yeah.
NLO may have some kind of pseudocup factors in it, effectively, or not.
Yeah,
does it have the leading log resummation stuff going
on? No, I don't think so. It's just giving the right
the
matrix elements fed into Hurwitz. So here we have to be more careful about the renormalization scale, and this is my choice that I'll be using from now on, where SF is the partonic S. I won't even bother putting in K-factors or anything. So Alpgen generates different samples with different numbers of jets, corresponding to varying numbers of partons in the underlying hard scattering. So it then uses a jet parton matching scheme to avoid double counting, because Hurwitz itself will be generating jets, so you don't want to be double counting these jets. It's also a standard model tool, so I'll have to model T prime decay in the same way as before. But the results are very similar to Mackinac. So even though the one loop effect is not here, it seems like getting at least the right tree level amplitudes is important and causing good agreement with Mackinac. And then we can use Alpgen with Pythia and again get very similar results. So all the tools that introduce improved matrix elements are giving very similar results, and results that are actually quite nice in signal to background. And the odd one out was standalone Hurwitz, and therefore we can also wonder about standalone Pythia.
Can we come back from standalone Hurwitz? I thought, well, that's first of all, Mackinac, of course, has the higher order corrections, but Alpgen does or doesn't.
It has tree level descriptions of more partons, which Hurwitz does not have.
Oh, Hurwitz is just 2 into 2.
Just 2 to 2.
Yeah. I see.
And okay. Same with Pythia, it's just 2 to 2. And, but they try to, as you will see, kind of mock up these other effects, but they don't put it in properly.
So this is a little bit of a surprise, because I thought that the exact matrix elements for, you know, many part-time final states always gave a bit more cross-section out on wings than, you know, per weight would, and such things would, you know, initial and final state radiation sort of generating in a leading log fashion the higher PT stuff. But what you're saying is that the reverse is true out where you're looking?
Well, see, I'm looking at the HT tail, and you're talking about the PT tails of jets.
Mm-hmm.
And Herwig and Pythia are kind of tuned to fit the PT tails, but as a byproduct, their HT tails are way inflated.
I see.
But it's the HT tails also seems to be correlated with estimating backgrounds. Okay, but there are other reasons to consider standalone Pythia. You know, it's got many, many dials to play with. And it has these models of the underlying event, and along with that are models of showering. There's a Q-squared ordered shower and a newer PT-ordered showering. Theoretically, the PT one has some justification. But both of these are still seriously used. As I understand it, the CMS collaboration is more still on the Yolder showering, whereas Atlas, I think, is looking at the PT ordered showers. But another thing that Pythia has on top of either of those showers is something called power showers. And what it does for us in the TT bar background is for the initial state radiation, it's putting a very high phase space cutoff on that, just for the reason that we were just talking about. If you turn the switch off, then you can get a phase space cutoff more of the order of the S hat of the hard process. So let's just look at the effect of that on the HD tails now in a log plot. So the signal is out here somewhere, and a factor of 2 or almost 3 if you turn on these power showers. So these power showers actually give you something that looks similar or maybe even slightly larger than the Herwig, standalone Herwig. And why they're even doing that is just for what we just said. That I think they're trying to model the PT tails of jets.
Sorry, so what is, remind me the definition of HT.
Just a scalar PT sum.
Okay, so how if they're getting the PT right, how could the scalar sum of PT be wrong?
Well, this is scalar PT of everything.
The only other thing is the missing energy.
Missing energy is there.
Some missing energy, but
that comes entirely from the measurement of the jets.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about PT, you're talking about the PT of the highest jet, and that's the highest. So they could be fitting to the highest jet one.
So
and HT is getting contributions from all jets. So it's...
So the only thing that I can think of would be the extra radiation. I mean, if there's an extra jet, so the distribution of that extra jet must be different.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like they might be focusing on the first two hardest jets, but then there's all these other jets in there. And
so you're saying so they tune in to get the hardest PT jet?
I think that's what they're fitting to with these power showers. The hardest, maybe next to hardest. So the power showers looks more like standalone Herwig, but I don't think we want to fit to standalone Herwig. We want to have something that looks more like what Alpgen and McIndoe are doing. So I'm turning off the power showers.
So are these presumably giving you the same cross section? So you have to make up for this high HT excess by a low HT decrease in the low HT region. Not having a power shower, at least. I guess that's what I see, but it doesn't look like enough to me.
I mean, this is adding very little to the total cross section, these tails.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, the next leading order effects were gigantic, gave you a gigantic change in the total cross section,
mm-hmm.
even though they seem to dampen the tails. So let's just look at two of these tunes of Pythia. A DW Brickfield-based tune is a popular one based on the older model, and one based on the newer model. Both have to use CTEC 5L, so I'm changing the PDFs in midstream here. And these two happen to share something in the underlying event. The comparison is pretty good, though. The background is maybe higher than the Alpchen Mackinnell backgrounds. And of these two, the newer one is probably a little worse signal to background.
What is the difference between the two tunes?
There's not much difference between that. So there's pretty good agreement after I've turned off the power showers. Then you can get pretty good agreement. Power showers, though, are the default in the newest Pythia, so. Let's just increase the T prime mass and see what happens. So for that, I just scale up these cuts. And let's compare Mackinlow to standalone Pythia. And here the differences are more easy to see. So I'm basically going further out on tails, and the better matrix elements improve things quite a bit over standalone Pythia.
Does Mackinlow have the initial state radiation in such a thing, or how do they deal with that?
Well, it's just being fed into Herwig, and then Herwig is adding on the initial state radiation.
So, but it's still all basically two into two processes with the Herwig initial state radiation add on.
Well, no, well, Mackinlow has the third jet, so it's two into three.
Okay.
And then Mac,
I
and then Herwig will dress that up.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I see.
And if you're interested in the KT jet, let's compare that. So the top is KT jet, and this is an older plot that we saw for Cone. And the Cone does quite a bit better.
What did you use for the KT jet R parameter?
Oh, if I can remember, 0.5, I think. I tried to optimize it a bit, but that's the best I could do.
I'm surprised by this. I would think that you should get almost identical results here. The thing that worries me is that, so this R parameter is correlated with the mass, right? So, your WP going left isn't as good. It probably means that there's maybe some optimization left to be done. Size and or arc parameter.
Yeah, well, I tried.
Okay.
I did. And that's why it would have been nice to have John here. I have discussed this with him. I'm trying to find from him why KT doesn't. He says the same thing, it should work as well. But I can't make it work as well.
I hope the experimental group wasn't steered off by the fact that this is the theoretical seminar topic.
Yeah, I mean, aren't experimentalists under pressure by theorists to go towards the KT? So maybe they would have liked to hear this. Anyway, let's go back to the HT tails. The highest one is the Pythia with the new showering, so it's a little higher than the rest. All the rest pretty well agree. And of course, again, I've not included power showers or standalone Herwig, which would be way up here somewhere. But look at the bottom one here. This is taking Pythia and turning off initial state radiation. And you drop way down there. So on our mass reconstruction plots, there would be hardly any background at all. So again, that's another indication just how sensitive background is to how you model initial state radiation. And that doesn't look that nice, actually. So let's look a little more carefully. Another thing wrong with this plot, there are different PDFs involved in some of those things. So let's standardize on one tune and one PDF. QW is just the DW tune, but tuned for a newer PDF. And let's just compare these strange standalone Pythia results to Alpgen Pythia. So the top one is standalone Pythia, and it drops way down there when you turn ISR off. But look at the two Alpgen results with and without ISR. So that looks very nice. So I think that's another good reason to be using Alpgen Pythia.
Well, once again, I just have to keep reminding myself, Alpgen has the multi-jet matrix elements in it, so that it's probably mimicking ISR pretty effectively is the point, right?
Well, it is. It's probably
it's got
a better description.
ISR in an exact matrix
element
sense.
Yes. That's how I interpret that.
Yeah.
It just seems like the standalone tools are, if you're not careful, are overestimating your backgrounds. Okay, it's the multi-jet background is non-trivial to talk about or to deal with, because there's just such a tiny fraction surviving. So how do you generate enough events? Well, Alpgen comes to the rescue again, because it can be used to divide and conquer in the way it separates things into different jet multiplicities. The relative sizes of these samples are determined by this parameter in Alpgen, which is the definition of what the jet is, the minimum PT.
Can you remind me what that means? Is it some kind of KT, whatever it is, definition of what it defines a jet? So this is PT min of various particles with respect to some central axis or something like that? Or
whatever the standard definition of PT is. It's just...
Well, I wouldn't think it would just be the overall PT, I thought.
Of a jet. So if we chose, like I'm going to choose 200 GeV, if you had a 150 GeV jet, it wouldn't count as a jet. So you might...
I see, it would combine it into... Okay, so this is really truly the PT, normal PT of a jet. Let's see. I guess I might have guessed that it would be more like this KT ordering sort of definition.
No.
But it's not at all. I
no.
see. Okay.
If I say I have three jets, I really mean three jets with PTs greater than 200.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we would like the three-jet sample to at least be larger than the two-jet sample in the signal region, as you'll see why in a sec. And that happens when PT min is not too large. On the other hand, the larger PT min is, all the cross sections are going down, which is what also we would like. A compromise is 200. The two jet sample still is where all the cross section is sitting, so it's enormous. But now I can cheat, because I can remove the B tag to generate enough events that you can actually see, and compare those events to the 3 plus 4 jet events. By removing the B tag, I just mean the B tag is gone, but you still need 200 GeV in the jet. So after that comparison, then I can throw away the two jets and just correct the 3 plus four jet samples with a correction factor. So I'll just show that here. So if I just remove the B tank, then the two jet sample in the signal region is maybe half the 3 plus 4 jet. So I can just throw away the 2 jet and multiply the 3 plus 4 jet by, say, 1.5. And that gives me this final result for a signal to background. And now we got something completely different to what we're used to looking at, because the background now is completely dominating the signal. We have to do something to improve this, and the trump card we still have yet to play is the other W, and we can require that it decays in a leptonic way. And so we're looking for isolated leptons and or missing energy. So this would be a loose and a tight cut. And that's very effective if we believe PGS-4.
So if you require the second lepton, that gives you more missing energy. But I guess HT is such a, it's still a reasonable thing and looks more or less the same, is that right? And the W mass, this, well, and also the overall reconstructed. But you can't reconstruct the W mass anymore, I guess.
No, I'm only using the W that I've identified the other way. I've identified one W using its hadronic decays.
Mm-hmm.
So I use that W with a B jet to reconstruct the T prime. So that's what's going into this plot. It's just that at the same time I've required elsewhere in the event some missing energy and or isolated leptons.
You could use the MT cut. MT is the to measure W mass at the spectrum, that will still work for events which have lots of extra jets in a TP bar, as long as the W just goes to L nu. So, I mean, that would cut off the high side, and it would also put a kind of low values of HT. It's got a peak at the W mass, and then it drops down very quickly.
Maybe we can talk a little more later.
Okay.
Yeah, so if we believe PGS-4, the backgrounds are pretty well reduced, almost gone altogether. The signal, though, is, of course, dropped by a factor of almost 5.
If you go back to what cuts you put in just the previous page, I'm not sure I understand. So, I see.
I have to redo the TT bar background, and it doesn't change much signal to background.
So is there any reason to use the tight cut, given that the loose cut seems to more or less do the job?
Yeah, it's only how well you believe PGS-4. If PGS-4 is not treating missing energy right, then you don't want to use that loose cut. Yeah, just to show the difference. How about the other process, B prime involved in the production and decay? It's interesting if we could try to use this jet mass technique to identify not only the W but also the T. Just try to capture all the decay products of the T also in one cone. But one cone doesn't do a good job really for either, so we have to compromise, choose 0.8, and widen the bounds on the allowed jet mass. Just going through the same kind of procedure, we find that this is harder to see. It would take longer to find this. Signal to background looks okay, but the number of signal events have gone way down.
By the way, what luminosity are you using here?
Everything is 4 now.
Oh, 4, okay. And before, for the previous one, it was...
B Before we got into multi-jets, it was 2.5. Okay, well, let's move a little more towards the theory side of things and talk about the fourth family constraints. Like I said before, the main thing it has to do is produce a positive delta t. These are the values if you remove the light Higgs. So, we have four masses to play with. And the approach I'll take here is looking at the lepton ones and asking, for what values are in that space, what region is allowed that would give you these results? And you also want to avoid tuning between quarks and leptons. I'll use these expressions for S and T. There's a cutoff involved because these should be mass functions falling in the ultraviolet. But I'm just using constants, so there's a cutoff dependence. And there's some minus signs. John's responsible for that one. So the plots have these yellow regions, which are the allowed regions that will give you enough positive delta t. And the higher contours are leading to more and more cancellation between quarks and leptons. So if you're in this kind of region, it seems to be okay. The red lines are going from 0.1.2 for S. So they also are trying to force you more in that direction. So at the one sigma level in S, you're also looking okay. Yeah, so let's talk about the how to represent the dynamics underlying the mass generation of the fourth family. So effectively represent that by a four fermion interaction, which is good up to some scale. And this is like the old NGL model. And in such a picture, there's also a relation between the electroweight symmetry breaking scale, 250 GeV, and the mass of the heavy quark. So that's where our estimate of 600 or even as high as 800 is compatible with. But the main thing...
That was for what value of lambda?
Roughly twice. But this whole approximation is slightly uncertain, so anywhere between 600 and 800, I think there would be no problem. But given that we've removed the Higgs, we have no more Yukawa coupling, so where are all the other fermion masses coming from? And this is the main thing we're learning in this picture, is again, four fermion operators effectively must describe the physics which feeds mass down from the fourth family to lighter families. So similar operators accept a different lambda, but that lambda cannot be arbitrarily large. At most, maybe 1,000 TeV. So that's the main point here, that there's a whole theory of flavor physics just sitting quite close by. And then you can wonder about the whole question of model building. Here I'm just, as I said, going bottom up, looking at some of these approximate symmetries on this type of operator. Now, in many or all attempts at dynamical symmetry breaking, the T-mass has always been a sticking point. So let's just look at the third and fourth families and consider approximate symmetries. Here are two charges or generators of symmetries that are axial-like acting on the third and fourth family quarks. If we're talking about mass-generating operators, then that's why we need some kind of axial-type symmetry to just put some kind of constraints on those operators. So let's just take these all the various operators and split them up into categories. The first will have operators that are neutral under both of those charges. The second set will have a Q charge, and the third set will have a Q twiddle charge. Notice the first two sets can be generated by gauge boson exchange, whereas the third set has this different structure, left, right, left, right. So the only way those can be generated is through some non-perturbative physics. Now the first set is what we've already seen. These are the ones you saw in the last transparency where they're generating these masses. These two sets are feeding mass down from the heavy quarks down to the lighter ones. The second set are those that are, like I said, generated by gauge exchange. These are ones that are all in the old ETC models. And the trouble is that in those models, there were related gauge exchanges that gave operators that you didn't want, leading to, say, T contributions or ZBD bar. And that's basically the problem with the T mass in these, in a whole class of theories, is that a large T mass gives you things that you don't want. But arranging things in this way, you see, well, there's an option here. Let's assume Q is a pretty good symmetry that would reduce or suppress all these operators, but you're still up with those operators. So it's just saying that Q is a better symmetry than Q twiddle. And so here's an operator that can generate the top mass. And I'll call that the top mass operator from now on. The B could be receiving a mass here or from one of these more suppressed operators. Either way, whatever physics this is that's generating this operator has to badly break SU2 right. So just at first sight, it looks this like at least we have a way out. I have a symmetry reason to suppress things we don't want and still get a top mass. We have to look a little more carefully because these operators in turn can generate those ones back again. The dangerous operators though were Q twiddle neutral, whereas the mass operator was not. So you need two insertions of this T mass operator to generate the dangerous stuff. So there's suppression MT over MT prime squared and a loop factor. So that helps in this problem. Another thing that happens with this T mass operator, it feeds back on the B prime mass in a diagram like this. And this is what leads to a prediction in this picture that the B prime is heavier than the T prime. So that's why it would make sense to treat the T prime decay more seriously, the one that I spent more time on. For leptons, the charged leptons are very similar to the quarks. What about neutrinos? I think it's natural to assume that the right-handed neutrinos are just not in the theory of the TV, and that they can have masses more like 1,000 TeV, where the flavor physics is. In that case, then, the origin of the light neutrino masses come from 6 Fermion operators. And so they're quite naturally in the EV or sub-EV range. This is something like a seesaw mechanism, but in the absence of a scalar, you see what the main result is, that the high scale has come way down from what you're normally thinking of, like the gut scale, way down to 1,000 TeV. just because we have six Fermion operators that have to be there instead of something involving scalars. The fourth neutrino has to have a large mass, but it can come from an operator like this in the same way as all the other fourth family members. The tau neutrino, you might ask, well, why doesn't it get a large mass like the T? You remember the T mass operator was Q invariant. In this case, you just can't find a Q invariant operator that generates this neutrino mass. So for this tau neutrino to be as light as we think it is, then Q would have to be a very good symmetry in the neutrino sector. But I think the main point here is that this theory of flavor can also include a theory of neutrinos. And so 1,000 TeV is really the upper limit on the origin of mass. Above that, you've just got a massless theory. Okay, let me just wrap it up then. So we found then that a sequential fourth family wrapped up with the electroweak symmetry breaking somehow in some strong theory is quite predictive. This process we found quite promising, and we found that this jet mass technique as a way to identify the W's also was quite helpful. I didn't say anything about the heavy leptons. They may be harder to see at the LHC, but the ILC might be ideal. We found, playing around with these event generators, that McEnroe and HelpGen are in good agreement and give nice results for signal to background. And HelpGen is very useful to be able to say you know what you're doing with initial state radiation. And then that leads me to this question. There seems to be a lot of work in Pythia by itself to tune it. For example, this business about power jets. They're tuning to something. Why not take Alpgen or Madgraph or something that has the matrix elements and put that in with Pythia and then tune it? I don't know why there's not some effort being done there. And then as far as all the backgrounds, I'm claiming that the multi-jet one is the one to worry about. And maybe a full simulation will be needed before we actually really know. So if a fourth family was actually discovered, what would we learn? Well, of course, no elementary scalar. We could stop looking. We would learn that nature invokes dynamics at the scale it's needed and not to make life easy for theorists. And we would know that something, a theory of flavor is something worth thinking about because it's nearby. So you might see a sentence like this in a future press release. And the question is, how is this sentence completed? Is the next word an and or a but? So yeah, in the context of this, in these perturbative theories that theorists like so much, here are a few innocent questions. Okay, I think I'll stop there.
One more question, which is this kind of theory actually inconsistent with an elementary scalar, or couldn't you have both? I mean, you have to readjust your delta, your TS constraints, of course. But presumably you could have both, couldn't you? And so the discovery of a heavy top wouldn't necessarily exclude.
No, but a heavy top of the mass in a bundle but directly implies, right from that very old work, that the gold stones are strongly interacting with the top, with the heavy fermion. So So you can't have a light Higgs. That light Higgs means weak convergence.
But what if you just threw it in?
Well, yeah, if you threw in a scalar, it had nothing to do with anything.
No, it would still be a scalar that would connect to the Ws and what have you in the usual
way. Oh, it just doesn't couple the fermion.
Gauge probably. Just doesn't couple the fermion.
You'd have to have some reduced Bev, probably. You're getting the W mass from the fermion. So if you, you could throw in a Higgs with a tiny Bev.
And small Yukawa couplings.
Since
the
Bev is small, doesn't matter.
Yeah, to the fourth step, yeah, small Yukawa couplings as well. Of course, the Bev could also influence the mass contribution. But I'm thinking more from the point of view of the strong W scattering or something like that. It's through a Higgs. I mean, how much would you have to reduce the Bev? I mean, it's not, still not, I mean, maybe missing something, still not clear to me. Couldn't make WW scattered perturbed using sort of more or less standard Higgs. You say you have to reduce the Bev. Why do you have to reduce the Bev?
This fermions directly give a contribution to the W mass. That's about the right size. So the Higgs Bev has to be smaller. And how much smaller depends on how good those approximations were. They're estimating it. You know, they estimated this mass based on getting the W mass to come out right just from the fermion contribution. So the fermion loop, essentially, is giving the W mass in these models. So you need to reduce the Higgs Bev to get the right W mass.
But why would you want to do that?
Just to be perverse. Reason I would want to do it is because this previous work that I did on the fourth family with Poisson and McKay, we tried to put in a fourth family, but of course much lower in mass.
Yeah, well,
add a standard Higgs to it, but then of course there are all kinds of intermediate zones where. And that brings up another question.
That's
one of
still
our
possible.
One of our constraints was that we wanted these couplings in our constrained space, wanted the couplings to be perturbative after evolving up, and that of course greatly reduces the mass scale that you're allowed for this fourth family. We're of course quite happy to have this coupling be strong to begin with, and then presumably there's no statement that can be made about such things as gauge unification or anything like that, is that right?
There's still some tendency for couplings to come together, even with a strong fourth family, just because it is a family.
Yes, well, that's true. I mean, so does it? I guess that's another way of rephrasing my question. Does it make sense to consider evolving the usual gauge couplings up in the presence of strong interactions in this sector at a much lower scale?
It gets more difficult to estimate what is going on. But these would be corrections, order one corrections to the lowest order running, I guess.
Have you looked at Tevatron limits? Our top convener says they have some sensitivity to these things out to 600 or 700 GeV.
The fourth family?
Yeah. But
they've set a limit I saw that was more like 100 and something. Oh no, sorry. Forget, but it was much lower. There's a CDF result on a limit on a fourth pretty close, I think. Something like 200.
So she really said?
Well, they have some plot where they show the invariant mass of the